Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. In this episode, we'll be discussing weird casting choices in movies and TV, such as Tom Cruise's Jack Reacher, or a teenager Evan Hansen still being portrayed by a 97-year-old man. Also, Marvel is suing the families of its content creators. That's how you do business at Disney. Netflix just dropped a huge ta-dum event and reviews of Coming Home in the Dark, Witch Hunt, and Midnight Mass. Let's get on with the show. My name's Aaron Peterson, and apparently I've already been sued by Disney just for making those comments. Joining me today, my fellow host, John Davenport.
I will be now known as witness number one for the prosecution.
Amanda Sink.
Hello, hello, witness number two.
And Troy Heinrichs.
I'm on ScarJo's side.
Good.
What a stance.
That's the way to do it. So you're saying she should play the Ghost in the Shell. Is that what you're saying?
Maybe.
Okay.
I enjoyed it.
All right. Did you really?
Visually.
Well, I mean, there's so much I could... Never mind. I'm just going to walk away
I think he said enough, and it wasn't me this time.
Yeah. I'm walking away clean from this. You know, it's been a while since we were all together, like on one episode. You know that?
Yeah. I don't like it.
Okay. I was going to say something nice, but never mind.
Go for it. Say something nice.
No, I really enjoyed just doing one with John by himself. It was fun.
That was on Patreon. Nobody heard it.
Oh, man.
Yeah, nobody pays for that.
Hey,
we should do it more often than John.
Okay, let's not throw shade at the Patreon side.
Yeah, they're keeping you employed-ish.
Free employed. You're an intern.
It's keeping your internship going, man. It's keeping the lights on.
No, I was just going to say that I was reflecting today about how long it's been, and I was doing all the work to prepare, and I was like, oh, you know what, though? I really miss these guys. Like, I miss your faces. Uh-huh. I missed your voices. I did listen to the episodes that I wasn't here for, but yeah, I missed you guys.
I missed you too. Apparently, these two are very quiet. They're just like...
Yeah, they're like, well, we liked when you were gone.
Nothing. Crickets.
Okay, John, don't laugh too hard.
I mean, we just got more words than edgewise, John, I think is what it was.
Yeah, you know, I was able to actually complete a sentence without losing track of what I was about to say.
Don't blame her for that. That is 100%
That's all on you, dude.
No, I didn't say... Well, all right. No, maybe that is me. I see what you did there. Yeah, it's me.
I didn't do anything. It's literally just you. So I got back from Vegas. I had a work trip. I had to go to Vegas. Thank you very much. Got to hang out with an Elvis impersonator. It's a whole other story. So both flights out there, you get entertainment, right? You know, in the plane, you actually have the video player in front of you and the seat behind you and whatnot, of course.
Any strippers?
As long as somebody doesn't recline, which is always, there's always a jackass who does that, but you get to, you know, watch movies on the plane. And I flew for probably 8-9 years. I flew every week or every other week. So I flew a lot. I have well over 600 flights under my belt. I have never seen unedited movies on a plane before. And now they have them. And I feel like the whole world has changed when I can sit there and watch sexy, violent stuff. And then the grandma next to me is looking over my shoulder and looking at me and judging me for the choices that were offered on this plane. I love it.
No, she was just asking to switch seats with you. That's what it was.
No. Or at least share a headphone with her.
Exactly.
I did ask her at one point because she kept staring at the screen and then looking at me and stared at the screen and looking
at me.
What
were you watching?
What was I watching? Those Who Wish I Were Dead or whatever. The Angelina Jolie movie was one of them.
Oh, okay.
And
that wasn't even that sexy.
And then Nobody with...
Bob Odenkirk, that is pretty sexy.
That was a little sexy.
And violent.
Yeah.
Very violent.
Yeah.
And she just kept looking at me like, oh, shame on you. And I'm just like, yeah, shame on me. This is awesome. You want headphones? I actually asked her that about halfway through. And she's like, no, thank you. And then proceeded to judge me further.
You totally missed the 12-year-old sitting behind him. That was the thing.
I was going to give him headphones too. I don't care.
Well, she was probably upset because all of a sudden that would have drawn too much attention to her watching 50 Shades of Grey or something.
It was on the plane. I would have put that on. I totally would have put that on. If it was unedited and you get to watch, hell yeah, I'd put it on. I'd be like, kid, come check this out.
You see, this is called a Dirty Sanchez.
Basic Instinct. I'm going to show you the scene right here. If this ever happens to you, I just need you to know it's going to be the best moment of your life.
Here's where God invented the pause button, kid. Right here.
Also, why you never have an ice pick in your house.
Mm.
That too. Sure. I mean, what if you need to chip ice? What are you supposed to use? A hammer?
Troy, nobody cares about that.
Yeah, we were having
a great
dirty joke. You bring it back to murder. Are you afraid of your wife?
Next is going to That's just going to be a prayer scene coming up, you know.
There's plenty of those in Midnight Mass.
Oh, my God. Everybody's praying. They should call it Midnight Monologue, by the way, because, my God, there are a lot of monologues in that thing. Jesus. Everybody's got... Every actor gets their turn at an entire monologue. Still a good show, though. I'm not...
Yeah, it was still really good. It's...
You know what? Let's talk about some things that are happening in a movie and TV world. And this is... I think it's a big one. I mean, they just had a case in 2014. Was it Kirby? Jack Kirby?
Kirby.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That almost went to the Supreme Court, and then Disney settled at the last minute.
It did go to Supreme Court, and then Disney settled.
Yeah, they settled because it was going there, right?
Or yeah, before close? They could actually make the ruling correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, because they don't, once you get it on the books, it's going to be hard to
undo.
Settle. You won't be settling right. Anybody. So here's what's going on, all right? Marvel is suing to keep the rights to the Avengers characters from copyright termination. We are not lawyers. We're going to just go through this as well as we can. If we get something wrong, call our attorneys, which we don't have. But if you subscribe to Patreon, you can help us get them. See? It all works. It's all cyclical. The complaints, which the Hollywood Reporter obtained, come against the heirs of some late comic book geniuses, including Stan Lee, Steve Ditko, and Gene Colan. The suits seek declaratory relief that these blockbuster characters are ineligible for copyright termination as works made for hire. If Marvel loses this case, Disney would have to share ownership of the characters, which is worth billions. And a couple fine points to this. Marvel is suing to hold on to full control of Avengers characters, including Iron Man, Spider-Man, Doctor Strange, Ant-Man, Hawkeye, Black Eye, Falcon, Thor, a bunch of others. In August, the administrator of Ditko's estate filed a termination on, or a notice of termination on Spider-Man, which first appeared in comic book form in 1962. And under the termination provisions of copyright law, authors or their heirs can reclaim rights once granted to publishers after waiting a statutory set period of time. According to the termination notice, Marvel would have to give up Ditko's rights to its iconic character in June 2023. And again, the whole Kirby thing where their case was going to the Supreme Court and Disney blinked and settled for tens of millions of dollars because they didn't want that to go and be settled and decided by the Supreme Court. They were concerned. So, John, you're an artist. You're a graphic designer. You do a lot of artwork. I know you have friends.
I'm an illustrator, not a graphic designer, but yes.
All right.
The difference.
There's a big difference.
That's a huge difference. That's not it's like
special effects versus visual effects. It's different.
Is this like the Ben Affleck argument in Chasing Amy?
No, this is like a real argument.
No, this is a real argument.
All right. Well, this is, I can only draw Garfield, so I have no idea. All right. So I'm obviously.
You do a really good Garfield, though.
That's a pretty bitchin' Garfield. I'm not going to lie. Someday I'll tell you about my art project. Maybe at the end, John, I'll tell you about my art project where I got failed for doing it better than the plan. But anyway. Beside the point.
Some people call that cheating or tracing.
It wasn't tracing. It's actually the argument.
What are you, inking? You know, are you an inker?
I'll tell you now. It was, you had to use graph paper. It was one of those graph paper deals where you had to do one section at a time. I didn't do it. I just drew it freehand. It was better than what the freaking picture was supposed to be. And he failed me for it because I didn't follow the rules, even though it looked better.
That's what school is about, indoctrination. Follow the rules.
Follow the rules.
I did it better.
Listen.
My mom still has it framed in her house. Still is framed.
But also, like, there's a whole reason, there's a whole methodology as to why that whole project was being presented to you for the graph paper thing. So as far as, like, did you resize it also? Did you make it bigger?
I made it fit the graph paper. It was almost exactly.
Same size?
Yes. It was literally almost a carbon copy, and I did not trace it. No. When I was younger, I was a very good artist. I stopped practicing. And you know, John, if you don't practice, you get very bad at it. So over the years, I just lost.
I'm in one of those modes right now. So the whole point of that process really is to teach you a way of like resizing artwork. So just to explain why he failed you. So if you have one thing and it's a certain size, if you put a graph over it and then, you know, you want to make it larger, then you put the same ratio graph on that blank piece of paper. And then you just draw everything in those little boxes as you go, and you'll eventually resize the drawing that you're doing. That's what that homework assignment was, and that's what he was trying to teach you.
I love that he said, "I'm going to tell you why he failed you. I'm going to tell you exactly why you were so wrong."
Right.
It was also to prepare you for how to use Photoshop, so that way you could actually make pixel art.
They didn't have Photoshop
in a digital age.
Yeah. Right.
All right. So back to the Marvel thing. Now, thank you. Finally, the seventh grade makes sense to me. I'm glad John's here to explain it.
No problem. That's about all I understand anymore is the seventh grade.
As an artist yourself, all of that stuff I explained with Marvel, what does that mean to you?
I need to point out that Disney and Marvel are playing both sides of the field on this, because what Disney has done is they essentially have done what the heirs of these comic book creators are trying to do by making sure that Mickey Mouse can never become public domain, and any of their characters can never become public domain, so that they always retain the rights to that. So now that they've exercised their right to be able to retain the rights to Mickey Mouse, now that somebody else who's created something else that they happen to have the ability to make their movies off of, they're now trying to play the other side of the field by saying, we have a right to do with, or block you from doing this. As an artist, what I have to say about this is that this is one of those things where back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and today, or there's a poor understanding of the amount of work that goes into creating a lot of things that are art related. So there's a song I've been hearing a lot lately, which is like, it goes, it costs this much because it takes me fucking hours. It costs this much because I don't have superpowers, you know? And the thing is like, you know, I have,
if we have to pay royalties for that, I'm going to be pissed.
Right. I have 44 years of experience, or you know, let's go with my actual, like, since I really started taking drawing seriously. So I have 35 years of taking art seriously and continuously practicing and being able to do what I do. So when somebody watches me draw, they're like, wow, that only took you 5 minutes. No, it took me 35 years to be able to do that in 5 minutes. To my whole point of this, artists need to be able to start taking their contracts a lot more seriously and stop being so afraid of starving a little bit because of what is going on with the industry and contracts. The deal with these Marvel creators is that back in the, they were still working off a rule, copyright rules from 1909, which gave them the ability of sharing creative rights over all of this. And as it should be, because somebody comes to them and says, hey, I got a great story. Can you draw the pictures for my great story? And a guy who can draw great pictures says, I'll draw the great pictures for your great story. And together we create iconic piece of gold, right? Mm-hmm. So those people together should be able to share rights. And sometimes like these companies will come in and say, well, no, I hired you to do something that was our idea. So that whatever I hired you to do, okay, great. If you want to hire me to do that, then it's going to be this much money. Or if you want me to do it cheaper, then it's going to be this much money plus a percentage of whatever the rights are moving forward for the rest of my life. It's something that I've almost lost my point, but you get the idea of this is a frustrating topic for me.
Yeah, it sounds like artists, when they originally did the works, they created the iconic images that the companies are now profiting from. And what they want to do is at some point, the studio or Marvel, as it were, they want their right to it, their 100% right to it to terminate so that they can profit off of all the money those creations have made. And currently, and these are usually heirs, right? It's all the families. Right. It's not actually the artists.
At this point, it is the families, which is a little bit of, like, I don't know. I kind of walk the line about how sick this makes me feel because, but at the same time, I get it. Like,
well, Stan Lee never got filthy rich off his, I mean,
he never got filthy rich.
I think
people
thought like he had Feige money, and then like, no, he never got to that level. I mean, he was always getting cameos and getting credit for it, but he did not make as much money as you would think he did.
No, he lived comfortably, but not as comfortably as he had the ability, as he should have been able to, because he got kind of like railed out of Marvel the way he did.
A $10 billion franchise.
Ditko's family, especially Kirby's family, like Kirby, Ditko, all these people, they deserve recognition. They deserve more than just having their name put on a movie, because at this point, like that is a legacy that they were able to create, and that legacy should be taking care of their families. Now, their families are turning around and saying, hey, that was my granddad's legacy, or that was my dad's legacy. I should be able to take advantage of that. That makes me feel a little bit sick, but at the same time, I get it.
Yeah, because that's my biggest challenge with this whole thing is like, why did the families have a right to the creation? They didn't do any work. It was their granddad that did the work, right? So the estate might have something, but the estate's been closed. And if the rights were already agreed to, even if the rights basically revert back to the original creator at some point in time, it's the original creator that gets that, not the kids. So it's like the kids are bringing the lawsuits, and I feel like that's a little bit of a catch-22.
It is a little bit of a catch-22, but the law actually states it goes to the creator or their heirs.
And if it's the estate, then the estate would basically be in control of that money. But what I was going to say is, it may be less about them trying to be greedy. This is me playing devil's advocate. And it could be something where a lot of people, especially of that generation, of Ditko's generation and Lee's generation and all of them, where you were just gracious to have the opportunity and you didn't fight it for, you know, tooth and nail for everything. You just said, okay, this is enough. What you're giving me is enough. Versus right. Later generations are saying, no, that was not enough. You've not given enough credit. You've not paid enough. Our family, like, it could have trickled down and affected their family. You know, if they didn't have enough money and he was sacrificing things to be able to pay for his vision and his artistry and all of those things, like, they want to be able to honor him. And a lot of times it's making a voice for the people who can't speak for themselves. And the only way to make things happen is through money. And so you're not going to be able to get anything with a recognition and say, I want you to say that they created all of this and I want you to put it at the forefront. They're not going to care about that. And there's not any laws that are going to be able to help you with that. But this is a law where they can try to utilize that and say, no, you're going to give proper credit to my grandpappy or whoever it is because they deserve it. Their legacy deserves to be honored in this way.
Right.
And they may take that money and donate it. They may create a foundation, a charity. A lot of times that's what happens. It does happen a lot. It does.
It can, but those people are fighting because there is a family out there who has the nicest house in the world and all this other stuff because they made ketchup, you know? So why is ketchup? Why? But nobody looks at those people and says, okay, well, you're a Heinz, you know, legacy and you get all this money because of Heinz and all that stuff. And nobody judges them because it's a ketchup company. So why is it any less for somebody to turn around and say, you created this amazing piece of work and it lasted generations and you should be able to collect money off of that. And that's what the truth really.
And let's be honest. They're suing now.
They would have fought sooner because I know – Troy, that's probably what you're leaning into is, but they're suing now. Well, yeah, there's money in it now. Back 15, 20 years ago, there wasn't as much money in Marvel. It was a dying comic book company. I mean, let's be honest. It was a dying comic book company. It made money by those characters becoming super popular and making billions of dollars worldwide. So there's money in it now. And the people that created it were too old or too unwilling to go against the grain. Stan Lee seemed by all accounts to not be somebody who wanted to rock that boat. He just wanted to kind of enjoy his ride. That's his right too. But in the same token, does that mean that they shouldn't be able to get that? Because I think if they would have sued 10, 15 years ago, they would have gotten more participation, but they also wouldn't have made much money. Would it really be worth it? Now it's worth it. And plus, yes, you do have families that are looking to start foundations, apparently.
I'm not saying that they're all going to. I'm just saying I'm trying to play devil's advocate. There are some good people out there.
I'm just saying the original work of art was a comic book drawn character. When you're creating a movie, it's a completely different medium. Two, the movie was created based on characters created by. They're not the actual characters created by. Like, for example, Wolverine looks completely different than what he does in the comic books. It doesn't look like two Batmans kissing. It looks like
Hugh Jackman. But you wouldn't have that. They wouldn't have any foundation if it wasn't for those artists.
Sure. Yeah, it doesn't. Like, it's like the way copyright laws work, that doesn't matter.
If you can prove its likeness, I think is what it comes down to.
Right. If the likeness is what really matters the most. So, like, the whole rule of, it doesn't look like the same as it did when they first created the character eons ago. Well, comic books don't even look the same as they did eons ago. So, like, that's just the way time works. Things get better. Things get easier to process and change. That's just...
And let's be real. They've already admitted that they have taken this as a basis from the comics. So it's not like they're saying, no, we made this ourselves, guys. This was our creation. They've already said, yeah, we came to this because of what you made. Yep.
Right.
But they're just not paying for it.
But there's already a contract in place for them to do that. That's the deal. They shouldn't sue because It just made a gazillion dollars over the last 10 years. There's a contract in place that allowed them to do this work.
True.
So renegotiate the contract instead of suing, you know?
They can negotiate a contract, which Disney will likely figure out a way to share profits in a way. So they will probably figure out some way to avoid this going into litigation and then risking losing the rights to all this. That's likely what's going to happen.
I don't think they lose complete rights to the characters.
No,
they only lose they're concerned about losing a portion. That's why they're taking the proactive approach and suing them,
right?
And saying, "I want to terminate this now before you guys get it in your head to keep suing us. We want to end this now."
Right. Well, you know, the other thing that they have to worry about is that, sure, it means that they can still make Iron Man, and then like Joe Blow, Miramax, or some other company that, you know, is trying to do something, they can also make a Iron Man movie because the owners of the rights allowed somebody else to make Iron Man movie.
And I also want to add this just for context for anybody who didn't read the article, not my co-host, but listeners, you who's
How
listening.
How dare you? I feel attacked.
No. They are not the lawsuit, the estate, the families are not trying to say, no, you can't use these creations. You can't use these characters. Don't worry. Your movies will probably be safe. It's just saying we should be sharing in some of that.
Yeah.
And you haven't
money.
Fairly. Yeah. You haven't fairly distributed that well.
What I love. Hang on.
You're greedy.
Hang on. I love this. I freaking love this. I have seen this all over the place. Whenever a company gets sued or sues anyone, like a major company, like the size of Disney, people automatically jump on the side of the person suing the company because screw big business, right? We all agree on this. Mm-hmm. It happens across the board. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But Disney gets sued this time with Scarlett Johansson, everything else, and people are on Disney's side all the mm-hmm. time. And I don't understand this. Like, at some point in these Marvel movies, have they put in some kind of subliminal hypnotic thing to convince us all that this company is good, all the others are bad? Because I swear I've never seen anything like it. Everybody comes down against the big business company on every lawsuit except Disney and Marvel, especially Marvel. And I don't get it. And people are going to say, that's not true. Go look at the internet, man. Yes, it is true. 100% true.
Well, in this case, especially the ScarJo versus Disney bit, like, it's annoying. Like, I can sort of see how people are annoyed with that whole process, because it's like, oh my God, ScarJo, who has all the money in the world, is just trying to get more money out of Disney, and she's just going to sue them for it instead of earn it. Like,
that's the thing. I mean, she had a contract.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Contracts matter, you know? Here too.
I mean, I'm on your side. Like, she can do. Yeah. Like, I'm pointing out is how people would actually the likelihood of what people are looking at that whole situation like, and why they're annoyed and why they're on Disney's side, because it just sounds like another Hollywood actor who's just kicking her you know feet on the ground and having a temper tantrum.
But here, I'm seeing are people, and I'm sure yes, there are some people that are on the side of the families and whatnot, but the majority of what I've seen across Reddit, Facebook, Twitter, wherever I've looked, has been these families are just being greedy and trying to get, you know, they just want to suck Disney dry. Point of fact, Disney's the one suing them first. I'm just pointing that out.
Right.
Like, just so you're clear.
Right.
And two, they're the families of the people that created the characters that you love. I mean, I don't know. If my grandpa created Spider-Man, I'd want some proof and recognition of that, not just his name on a screen. I'd be like, Pay him, put it in his name in a trust or something. I don't care, whatever, but some recognition that he got what he deserved. I understand that argument. I'm not saying legally it works. I'm just saying I understand the argument.
And Disney has a history of lawsuits about copyright issues. So it's not like this is the first time they've ever had to face this. I mean, you guys brought it up already, like a couple of instances with former comic book creators and even Disney's like actual Mickey Mouse lawsuit. Like, there's endless Frozen. There's so many different lawsuits that they faced over copyright, and they just seem to get away with it and get away with it and get away with it. And so that could be adding up to this point too, where they're like, man, you guys just, you are this massive conglomerate organization that is literally taking over the world one piece by piece. And we don't want you to take that wealth away from our family. you know, that could pay for their college. That could, you know, do whatever.
Yeah, they want to go to college. That's what they want that money for.
Yeah.
Not so they can afford strippers on their own jet.
What?
Right.
The problem of it all, though, is that copyright law is so fractured and so outdated for the type of medium that exists today. And so they're using laws that were created.
We'll be seeing some new laws for sure.
Yeah, way back before, and using that as a basis for new. There's no like precedent for, well, the streaming media count does a
right.
Like we were dealing with this, John and I were talking about this on the Patreon episode. The fact that I can watch the NFL game on my phone, but I can't watch the NFL game on my TV because I don't have rights to the larger screen format is just ridiculous. It's the same technology. Why do I have to do it this way? So for them to sue over a movie when it was originally a comic book character and you're not the original creator, it just seems like bollocks to me.
It can. I get that too. I get both sides of that argument. I really do. I do.
As an artist, I get both sides of the argument where I'm thinking, you know, at one side, I think if I create something that's pretty amazing and goes out in the world and becomes its, you know, takes its own life and you know, and just spreads like wildfire, pay me. My kids, on the other hand, if they sit there and they, which I don't have, but screw them. If they sit there and like, hey, my dad made that. That's about the most I want them to be able to say is, hey, my dad made that. And if I had any money left from them paying me, then they can have that money.
Right. Because at that point, I created by our John and the credits should be more than enough for the generations below you.
And whatever I have left it from that I haven't spent on blowing hookers and jets.
Exactly.
Right. Which you did all on your jet at the same time, if I remember right.
You're taking the Daniel Craig approach, because he just went recently. He was on being interviewed for James Bond all over the place, and he was very clear that he doesn't want to leave his kids a lot of money. Like that's on. I just feel weird about that. I made it. We'll enjoy it when I'm gone. Figure your own stuff out. I kind of like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the way it should be.
You guys are savages.
Generational money is bullshit.
All right. So let's move on to the Tudum event. That's Netflix's Tudum event. You know, Tudum, the noise it makes. Haha, get it? Clever. All right. Well, it involved announcements such as, and I'm going to go through a couple of these, and you just tell me if any of them really stood out to you. But The Witcher Season 3 has been announced, even though Season 2 isn't out yet, as well as the prequel series is going to come in next year, a second anime film. We got our first look at Neil Gaiman's The Sandman adaptation. Vikings Valhalla arrives next year. Tiger King is somehow getting a sequel documentary series. What?
That's amazing. Didn't one of those guys die?
What is happening? The Crown returns November 2022.
Oh, The Crown. Yeah. The best TV show that ever existed.
According to the Emmys, that is the greatest television show that's ever been on the face of the planet. Bridgerton Season 2 arrives next year, which is The Crown for people who like sex. Both parts of Ozark's final season will release in 2022. Stranger Things teased their fourth season with a flashback to the 50s with the Creel family. Cobra Kai returns December 31st of this year. Sex Education is getting a season 4. Sex Life is getting a season 2. And Cowboy Bebop had just about the best opening titles I think I've ever seen. Anything out of all that that really, you know, once you saw it or heard about it, you're like, yes. And please tell me it's The Crown.
No. No. It is not for me. There's a lot in there that I was already excited for, so I'm going to mention one that surprised me in my excitement. And the first thing is Cowboy Bebop. I just never cared, didn't think I would care. And watching that title sequence, I was like, this looks really cool. Like, I could really get into this.
Have you ever seen the opening for the anime?
No.
It's pretty cool. No. Did you see it, John? You're an artist. Or Troy, you love anime.
I haven't had a chance to sit down and watch it as far as the intro, but if it's anything like the anime, it's going to be cool.
It was really
exactly
cool.
Exactly like the anime, just with people.
That's pretty badass. I'm really excited to hear that. And I haven't even watched the most recent season, but freaking Sex Education is getting a season 4.
Yeah.
I thought season 3 was going to be the last season of the show. So I'm really thrilled for that. That's a great show, and I'm really happy for it.
How much education are they going to have?
It's got Gillian Anderson.
Gillian Anderson.
It's got Gillian Anderson in it.
What does it have to do?
And she does sexy stuff.
Now, are they airing this like,
in an accent?
Are they airing Sex Life right after Sex Education? Like after Sex Education, you get a Sex Life? Is that how this Netflix thing is working? I haven't seen either show.
Well, no, like yeah, bad joke. However, during sex education, there is sex going on.
All right. Well, that's how you learn, right?
Right.
Well, and his mom is a sex educator.
Right.
Just saying, I had sex ed in high school and they didn't even teach about condoms. Just saying. Obviously.
Well, you haven't learned about condoms until you've watched Gillian Anderson teach you about condoms that in an true. English accent.
I'm never too old to learn. What were you going to say, Troy? I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that I am super excited that I don't have to spend New Year's Day binging Cobra Kai like I did last New Year's, because now I get 4-day weekend in order to binge it so I can spread it out a little bit and enjoy it, which is fantastic.
Yeah, and you get a heads up notice.
I know. Now I can plan my 4 days appropriately.
I got to be honest, Troy. I will have that thing banged out on New Year's Eve.
Before, I will too. Probably New Year's Eve, and I have no party to go to.
Before I go to the party, whatever I'm going to do, I promise you I'll have that knocked out.
But it's nice to know I have the flexibility of the whole weekend because we have off of work on the 3rd. So,
if we get screeners again, I'll let you know and we can do a group party.
There
John
you go.
Can fly in.
Yeah, might as well. Otherwise, I'll be up here in fucking Gilligan's Mountain.
Jesus. So angry.
I just want to point out, he's angry. Amanda's throwing her press credentials around. And Troy's just like, I'm off for 4 days. Everybody's like, braggadocious. Let's humble brag it out.
All right. So can I ask about this whole Creole family for Stranger Things season 4? Am I missing something? Where did that come from?
There was a trailer that dropped and it shows the 50s and this Creole, Victor Creole, I think, and his family. And I don't know how they tie in, but that's a family from the 50s and somehow it's going to tie in to the 80s. We don't know
that's
yet.
That's his okay. question is how the hell this all connects.
How does it connect?
Okay.
Where does this come from?
Yeah. So then I'm assuming that we don't know anything about the Creoles then. They haven't mentioned them in any of the other seasons.
That's in my knowledge. Like, no.
All right. That's what I was wondering. Because I was watching that trailer. I'm like, this looks cool. What the fuck is going on? Why do I keep saying that?
Yes. Yeah. Can you stop?
A lot.
All right. Well, I'm just excited Witcher for sure is getting season 3. Because with Netflix, you never know.
You never can
you
tell.
Never know. So I'm glad we know that for sure.
One other thing I wanted to mention.
If it's Tiger King, no. I don't
it
care.
It is not Tiger King. Okay. It is actually an anime, which I'm not usually into, but Arcane actually looks kind of cool.
Oh, yeah, that looks cool.
It does look cool. It's based off of the video game League of Legends, and if you're a fan of that game, you will likely be happy with that show, I'm sure.
Are you a fan of the game, though, or are you a fan of the teams that play the game? That's really the question.
I used to play the game until the whole game got way too toxic to play.
Toxic?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it is super toxic.
Like the community or the game itself?
Yes.
The whole community is super toxic.
Because the community exists, the game is no longer fun to play.
Isn't that literally every gaming community? It's toxic.
No, there are gaming communities that aren't like, no, you don't even understand.
I play Xbox all the time. I can't remember the last time anybody said a pleasant thing on there that wasn't some kind of insult, like, blah, 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 blah,
right.
And I banged your mom. You know, that's basically how everything ends.
But that's, you know, Xbox, trust me, I played that game for like 2-3 years and how toxic that game gets is ridiculous.
Like a bunch of incels?
It's even worse than that. It's like if they will report you for anything, like if you don't even play the game right, they'll report you for, like, they'll make up some reason to report you for it. They'll find something going on. I mean, we don't really, we should bring Scott on for this because maybe he knows, but.
He doesn't play multiplayer games. If you're talking about Scott Clark, the former Hollywood Outsider host, he doesn't play multiplayer games because he's too competitive. So he quits 5 minutes into it. He'll tell you that's not true, but Troy, you know it's true.
True story.
Well, now I want to play competitive games with him just so I can see him lose.
Well, if he's winning, he'll keep playing. But if he loses, you won't see him on there ever again.
I can relate.
I hope you're listening. And just a few other things.
I have a great video game story that relates to that now.
Do you?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
All right. So
it's not about Scott, friends, though, 'cause I don't want to make him sad.
No, okay. It's not about Scott. So
I make him
my friends,
sad.
My friends got into one of these like Battlefield games and I had my good friend Joe was like, hey, you need to play this game with us. And I'm like, I don't really want to play it. And Joe's like, I want to get your dog tag. So you have to come play this game. And it was like a month and a half of listening to him talk about Battlefield Bad Company and about getting my dog tags out of the game. Mm-hmm. And I paid the $50 for the game. I log in, we're all having a good time. I'm in this house shooting at people. I turn around, here comes Joe right for me. I get his dog tags. I log out because now I'm just laughing because he didn't get my dog tags and I never played the game again.
Are you guys still friends?
No, we're still friends. Okay. That's $50 I've ever spent because everyone was laughing at it.
That's fantastic. And you didn't want to play it anyway. You're like, ah, I'm out.
Yeah.
He didn't quit it. I like it. All right, just a few other things. Pitch Perfect is getting a spinoff TV series with Adam Devine. Eddie Murphy signed a movie deal, a three-movie deal with Amazon Studios, and Babylon 5 is getting a reboot with the original show's creator, but it's for the CW.
No thanks.
I want to see what they do.
You're going to get soap opera, teen, well, pretty people in space.
Maybe, but they did such a good job with that one. What's that show? That space show that they did?
The 100.
Yeah, I just finished the 100. I don't need to watch more seven seasons of Babylon 5 doing what the 100 already did.
Mm. Right. No, but my point is like the 100 was the closest thing that like at the CW was ever going to produce that was like Game of Thrones. As far as nobody's really safe. They liked killing off their characters. They, you know, if you liked somebody, likely they were going to turn into an a-hole or die. Like that was pretty great. So now I decide to clean it up. I want to see what they do with Babylon 5. I want to see what kind of show they deliver. I didn't watch the original, but I think CW with some HBO money behind it might come up with something fun and exciting.
I feel like if the CW would do something like The Orville, which by the way, season 3 is finally a go,
yeah.
Heads down for New Horizons on March 10th, 2022.
I'm excited for
it'd
that.
It'd be amazing that it's coming back. Yep. So if Babylon 5 can be more like The Orville on the CW, I would watch it. Versus like if Babylon 5 is going to become the 100, like I'm out because it's just not what Babylon 5 is.
So you want to see an irreverent version of Babylon 5 is what you're telling me.
It would be better. It'd be funnier. I don't want to watch a teen rom-com.
I want to see Sam and Jensen show up. Sammy! Just some guy in the background randomly walking around lost. Sammy!
I think you honestly would just want supernatural references in every CW show. That would get you to watch other CW shows, I think.
Yeah, because I stopped watching CW shows a long time ago.
All right, well, we got to move on. But first, I want to take a second to talk to you guys about something very, very personal, about family.
Ah!
Because no matter how fast you are, no one outruns their past. Vin Diesel returns for the 9th chapter of the worldwide blockbuster series in F9, The Fast Saga. And this is one of the wildest entries yet, and is setting up the final two films. Also starring John Cena, Charlize Theron's in this one. You can own F9, The Fast Saga, with the never-before-seen director's cut and all-new bonus content on 4K, UHD, and Blu-ray and digital. Check it out. Vroom! Family.
Can someone explain to me what UHD means?
Ultra
HD.
But how does that differ from HD?
It's ultra. Also, we have several copies of F9 to give away. And if you'd like a chance to win a copy of Fast and Furious 9 or F9, The Fast Saga, you can share this episode on your favorite social media outlet, whatever it is. It can be Reddit, Facebook, Twitter, whatever it is. And email us a screenshot of that at contest@thehollywoodoutsider.com. That's contest@thehollywoodoutsider.com before October 8th with the subject line, obviously, family, and your name, and you'll be entered to win. We're giving away several copies of it, so make sure you do that. Contest@thehollywoodoutsider.com. Also, our show is independently funded. Therefore, all the expenses are from our own pockets, and Patreon helps fans support their favorite podcasts. Once you sign up, you get immediate access to all the content in your respective tier. Our recent contributor that just joined up, Alexandro Amatrano. I hope I said that right. Thank you so much for your support, Alexandro. Boop, boop. Welcome aboard. I hope you enjoy, I believe, From Dusk Till Dawn for Bad Movie Night, which is a movie we enjoy. Don't read that the wrong way. It's a movie we enjoy. So that just went up, as well as our bonus episode where Troy and John, I only heard the first 2 minutes, but they took over a whole episode because Amanda and I were both unavailable. And the only thing I heard was Aaron's a dick. So I don't know what else is in there,
but statement.
It's juicy. It's juicy. And if you want to support the show,
so juicy,
you can sign up at Patreon, patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider. Thank you. Now we're from the outside in topic. This this week's podcast topic revolves around weird casting choices, like a 30-year-old playing teenager Evan Hansen, Tom Cruise, little Tom Cruise playing the 6'5 Jack Reacher. Seriously, if you're a reader of the books, it's not the same character, but he still did a very nice job, but whatever. Gary Oldman playing a dwarf in Tiptoes, a movie that actually has Peter Dinklage playing another role. And Oldman is coincidentally Matthew McConaughey's twin brother somehow. That's true. Look it up. Tiptoes. What the hell is happening? That's what that role should have been called in that movie. So we're talking about really weird choices. Now, by the way, anybody ever seen Tiptoes? Don't. just look up that information because I am not making that up. Gary Oldman played a dwarf in a movie that literally has Peter Dinklage in a different role. It's weird. It's just weird. Okay, so weird is a relative term. And oftentimes the casting works out. Tom Cruise is definitely not the book's Jack Reacher. I've read a bunch of those books. He is not that character at all. Jack Reacher is a fairly unattractive. He's an average looking guy, very imposing, but that's about it. And also a very good detective and ass kicker. So even though it's not the book Jack Reacher, he did manage to make the character his own. And he kicked a lot of ass playing him. I think he did a very good job as Jack Reacher. It's just not the book's Jack Reacher. So it was weird casting, just weird. So what do you think has been the weirdest casting choices you can remember? We're going to go round robin. Amanda, you can start. Like, start with your first one and why it was so weird for you. And whether it worked or not, that's up to you.
Yeah, so the first one that came to mind immediately was Heath Ledger playing the Joker in The Dark Knight.
Yeah, we were all worried about that.
Yeah, I mean, he was always kind of like a sweet, quirky, cute character sort of thing, and historically, there's been a lot of Jokers, and most of them are pretty good. And so he had some competition to come up against. And I think I can speak for the general population that he astounded all of us beyond belief. I mean, to this day, he's still my favorite Joker. I just couldn't believe the performance that he gave.
It's funny because if you look back now, well, yeah, he's the best Joker. He's great. He's wonderful. I love him. He's definitely better than Jared Leto. But at the time, you're right. I mean, he was just not a guy you could picture in that role. And at that time, what a lot of people don't remember is Jack Nicholson was still pretty beloved in that role from when he played in Tim Burton's Batman. So even though his was over the top and very cheesy and whatnot, people loved that performance. Heath Ledger made it real. He made it dark. He made it sadistic. And I think that's just what endeared him to so many people.
Yeah, I remember the press around the time and people used to complain about how dumb of a decision that was. It was all over the internet or whatever was the internet at the time. And it was
message board.
You could not miss. Yeah, you could not miss how people were complaining about their choice. And then as soon as he portrays that character, everyone turned right around.
I mirror it to the Gal Gadot experience where everyone thought she was too tiny and she couldn't.
Including me.
me too. Thought she was too tiny, thought she didn't have enough, you know,
boobs.
Oomph to her character or that. And when she hit the screen, we were all like, damn, we were very wrong.
Absolutely.
We apologize deeply for being so wrong. And so it's the same experience where you essentially just underestimate them based on what you know of them and your perception of them. And then they come out and they shine and you're like, I couldn't picture anybody else doing this.
Mm-hmm.
What a great honorable mention you snuck in there.
Thank you so much.
Well done. Yeah, very well done.
that was like seamless. That was like, congratulations.
Yeah. Because, I mean, all people really knew about Gal Gadot was she can roll her ass onto a runway really well in Fast 6. I mean,
and I'm sure come back to life in Fast 10 or Fast 11.
Oh, God, they're probably working on it. If they can afford her, she'll be back. Sure.
Yeah, she's probably expensive now.
She's pricey. Troy?
I think part of the problem, too, is that people come in with preconceived notions because they base people on their past work and they base them what they look like versus like actually thinking about, oh, hey, I'm an actor. If I do the right training or put on enough weight or do my hair a certain way, like they're supposed to be able to become any one of these characters. And I think that was the case with Heath. I mean, he just really got himself into the mindset of what it was to be the Joker. And then, you know, obviously dealt with some of that fallout after the fact, but really, really a surprise when this actually hit the screen, because you're just like, wow, is that the same guy? Is that the mm-hmm. same guy? Like 10 Things About Hate About You, same guy? Really? Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think even now looking at, because I love 10 Things I Hate About You, and he is adorable in that movie. And comparing that to Heath Ledger's Joker, it's just like, gosh, is it really the same person? And I think that's what strikes me so much, is that I have to still contemplate, like, how did he become such a different human being?
Brokeback Mountain.
It's the process. I mean, that's what acting mm-hmm. is.
Troy, you're up.
All right. Well, I'm going to go with my first one, which was Jake Gyllenhaal, speaking of Brokeback Mountain, and Prince of Persia, Sands of Time.
Yeah. Because he's playing a brown guy. Yeah.
That is like, yeah. Step number one, like, stop whitewashing Hollywood. Step number two, he may look good in a cowboy outfit, but he's not a prince. He doesn't have a commanding figure, nor does he look anything like
that. Whoa, whoa,
okay,
whoa,
let's
whoa,
back
whoa.
That train whoa, all whoa, the way whoa. Up into
I
another
got horny
universe.
Watching that movie. What are you talking about? I thought I was on Brokeback Mountain watching that. He was so oiled up and sexy.
He
I'm going too far,
a
but
handsome,
you get the
beautiful
point.
Man.
Okay, yeah, I'm just saying. Whitewashing, like, yes.
Everything
he's
else
a cowboy.
He can be my prince, Troy.
But he's not a prince. He's not princely. He's not
yes,
kingly.
He wasn't a prince in the movie. He was a homeless kid that the Sultan picked up.
If you know but what I mean.
I just rewatched it, so.
I like that
I feel
movie.
Sad for you.
I like that movie.
You must really be bored in the mountains
I do
up there.
Like
Holy
that
cow.
Movie. I thought movie. This was going to be a positive
it's
one.
It's totally offensive. I get all that, and I agree with all that.
Yeah.
I still like it.
Uh-huh.
But go ahead, Troy. Why is it weird for
no,
you?
No, I just feel like playing the video game, comparing it to the actual, like, movie itself, it just didn't work. It's the wrong casting choice for me. The whole movie probably was the wrong choice to make in the first place also, but different conversation.
I agree he's the wrong person to cast in that role, even though I kind of enjoyed it. It's kind of like, it's like Johnny Depp in The Lone Ranger. He should not be yes. him, but I still enjoy right. the movie, you know?
Or Emma Stone in Aloha.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, she's not any... Where did you think she was Asian? Like, what?
Did you hear, I think it was the director who had said something...
Cameron Crowe.
I don't know.
Cameron Crowe directed
yeah,
that
said something like, I didn't realize that the majority of the population was Pacific Islander. And I'm like...
On the Pacific
in
Island?
In Hawaii? Yeah,
he swallowed a lot of crow on that one. I'm proud
so
of that.
Dumb.
I just made that up on the spot. Clapping for myself. John, what do you got?
What? Oh, sorry. I got my first one is one that, you know, when everyone said that this person was going to play Batman, everyone was like, what? Are you kidding me? And that's Michael Keaton as Batman.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
And it's actually a Batman that works. Although when you look at Michael Keaton, you don't sit there and say, hey, that's a man that should be Batman.
But is he? I like him because I think he is a man who looks like Bruce Wayne.
No, I don't think he is that either.
I don't like him in either part. And I know it's sacrilege to say, but I love Michael Keaton.
How dare
you? I don't like him as Batman. And I do you want to get nuts? I mean, I just don't.
I concur yeah. with Aaron.
Okay, you just sold me on not liking him for Batman.
Just, he never once felt threatening to me. I felt like he was always wrong for the part. That's a personal choice, and I know the world's against me on it. Go ahead. Aaron at the Hollywood Outsider. You know what? Send it to Troy at the HollywoodOutsider.com. He might read them. Just no. Mm-mm.
But those movies were also right. different.
I still like
tone
the movies.
And style.
Mm-hmm.
They were very different.
Yeah.
So I think that's why it works, because of the tone and style of the movie and what they were trying to go for, versus if you look at the Dark Knight series, you know, obviously a much different tone. You need a much different Batman.
Agreed. So, John, but that casting choice worked for you is what you're saying.
It does work for me because I like how he actually fits very well in a gothic character, which Batman is a gothic character. So, because, hey, Gotham. But anyhow.
it's probably where the name came from.
Right. But, you know, he works as a gothic character because he has that... he does have a roguish quality to him as far as his appearance, and that does kind of work. But the rest of it, like, he's not an imposing figure. He's not the size of Batfleck, who's the right Batman. He's not the handsomeness of
Christian Bale.
You know, he's not the or any of the other ones. But yeah, he still works for me.
Well, my first one is the original Gangsta, and I'm going to have to explain why he's somebody that was a weird casting choice. I need to explain it because I don't know if you'd get it. If you don't know the history, you might not get why it was so weird to me at the time. So I grew up listening to Ice-T. Mm-hmm. I grew up, original Gangster and other works of his were staples in my world. Where I grew up, Ice-T and Eazy-E, they were basically folk heroes and how defiant they were of cops in both their music and their lives. I mean, Ice-T wrote a song once about killing cops. He was not a fan, or it seemed like he was not a fan of police officers. So when I heard Ice-T was going to be in New Jack City, it's a movie about a drug dealer in the projects rising to the heights of the criminal world. I just thought, damn, Ice-T's going to be a great Scarface. That's what I thought. I mean, he was a drug dealer before he was even a rapper. And then I go and see the movie, and he's not only playing a cop, but the cop determined to bring down Nino Brown, who's the drug dealer. I was like, what? What? This is crazy. That's the weirdest casting ever to me. And yes, very against type. And I guess that's what Mario Van Peebles wanted when he had the film in mind and he had Ice-T in mind. And Ice-T crushed it in that role. I mean, so well, he's been playing cops ever since. And that was weird. That was just weird for the time. Now, pretty common. I mean, he's been on Law & Order for 2 decades.
Yeah. I'm actually on a Law & Order trip right now. And it's nothing but Ice-T all the time. I thought when you mentioned New Jack City, I thought you were going to go with Judd Nelson because he is not the kind of cop that they were trying to portray him as, or he doesn't like fit that character very well. But Ice-T is a really good choice because he does really sell that role, and he has that when he's dealing with Chris Rock's character, it feels like he actually cares. Mm-hmm. When he's going up against Nino Brown, you know he's going up against his nemesis. It's a lot of power in that role,
and he doesn't lose his street cred when he's doing it. You know what I mean? Oftentimes, you know, in those kind of roles, he's almost too empathetic. And I don't think he was too empathetic. He just, man, get yourself right. You know, I mean, he just wanted things to be even and right. Mm-hmm. On the street, you know, as far mm-hmm. as that role went. And I think he played it really well, especially for a guy that really didn't have many acting credits. I mean, he jumped from I'm a rapper to you're the lead star.
Mm-hmm. This isn't business. This is personal.
And then at the end, when he dies and Judd Nelson just gives him that smile, that's one of my favorite moments in movies ever. Speaking of Judd Nelson.
Yep.
When he's just like, Nino Brown dies. Spoiler alert. And Judd Nelson, everybody else is panicking and he's just smiling. I just thought that was great. I freaking love that.
Yep.
Sorry. Amanda, back to you.
Well, my second choice is Vince Vaughn from Psycho.
Ugh, that hurts my soul.
Doesn't it, though?
Yeah.
So, if you're familiar with Hitchcock's iconic horror film, then the first person that comes to mind in a remake, whether it's satirical or serious, is not Vince Vaughn. He's not the guy I think of. Norman Bates as a character is reserved, is more withdrawn. And Vince Vaughn is very in your face and just something else. He is not the guy to be in Psycho. And Aaron, I'm sure you have a lot of thoughts and feelings on this as a huge Hitchcock fan and co-host of Presenting Hitchcock.
Presenting Hitchcock. Yes, which is a great podcast. You should check out. We did cover Psycho at one point. And our next episode is Rear Window. What? So excited for that. Yeah, it's a shot-for-shot remake, except for they added like one scene where he masturbates. Why? I don't know. Just apparently like Gus Van Sant thought that was a good idea.
Well, they probably walked in on Vince Vaughn and he was already doing it. And they were like, hey, turn the cameras on.
Get it rolling. Get it rolling. And then he's like talking really fast while he's doing it. I never understood the movie, the point of the movie. And I sure didn't understand the casting. I don't think he's awful in it. I just don't think he's the right guy for it. Or the movie was the right movie. Like if you're going to remake Psycho, add something new to it. Besides masturbation scene. Just otherwise don't do it.
So, yeah. I mean, there's a problem with like when you think about like Heath Ledger or even Jake Gyllenhaal, where you sit there and you go like, I can actually see them in the part. It's hard, but you can see them in the part. Or, hey, it really surprised me that they're doing this part. Like you do not see Vince Vaughn in this role at all. Like the entire time you see Vince Vaughn, it's kind of like Will Smith playing Deadshot. Like, you know, it's Will Smith the entire time. You never see the Deadshot character, so it just didn't work.
Right. I mean, it's still, Deadshot worked fine for me, but it was Will Smith the whole time. I just like Will Smith. I'm just like,
right.
Yeah, it's Will Smith as, you know, Deadshot, I think. I think sport. That casting,
Bloodshot.
That casting was totally because he was hot at the time.
Yep.
That's all it was.
All right. Well, I'm going to go with Keanu Reeves in a movie called Speed, because he had one action film, I think, prior to this, which would have been Point Break, where he was like a hip surfer dude, still more like a Bill and Ted character than a true action hero. And Speed really read more like a Bruce Willis diehard type character. And surprisingly, Keanu really pulls it off in the movie. I thought it was really fantastic watching him. And of course, the chemistry between him and Sandra Bullock really just makes that movie. So, but at the time when they were like, yeah, Keanu Reeves is going to do Speed. And we're just like, okay, what is the bus going to like time travel when it hits below 55 miles an hour? I don't understand.
That would have been amazing.
I really like that movie.
It's a great movie.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, it's a great movie. And you, dead on. That was weird casting. I remember when it came. And you know what? That was a huge hit. And then he didn't want to come back for the sequel, which boggled my mind, because that movie would have been good. But Jason Patrick, not so much.
Yeah, the sequel sucked.
Sucked. And you know,
well, did it suck because it was Jason Patrick, or did it suck because it was the sequel?
Yes, is the answer.
Both.
Yeah.
Okay. Both.
It would have been watchable had Keanu been in it.
Yeah, because, I mean, no matter what, it's he's usually watchable. Even in Point Break, where I will dare say his acting is bad, he's still...
Yeah, I think that's a given.
Yeah, it's an entertaining watch regardless. Uh-huh. Yes, Patrick Swayze is the main reason, but I can still watch him going, I still like the guy. It's like, I know he's bad at this role, but I still like him, and I can't figure it out. And in Speed, I thought he actually was... I don't know if he learned, maybe it's because he realized the FBI agent in Point Break was so awful. He actually went to do some law enforcement training. So he knew how to be a better cop because he actually seemed like a good cop in Speed.
Agree.
That's a whole lot of conjecture, but my third choice.
Second choice.
No time machines here.
So my second choice is a movie that's really near and dear to my heart because it's one of my favorites. That's Prince of Thieves, and it's Kevin Costner as Robin Hood, slipping in and out of that accent like crazy. As much as I want to sit there and give him a hard time for slipping in and out of that accent or fighting to keep an accent the entirety of the movie, I also forgot about it about the halfway point and was able to really just sit down and enjoy it.
At what point is he in the accent? Because I don't recall that point ever in that movie. I remember
him
thinking he's supposed to have one. At one point, you can see him look up to the sky and go, I think I should have one. But I never actually heard it.
I think right about the time he meets Morgan Freeman's character, there's no more accent.
It's just so weird.
I'm with Aaron. I don't remember him having an accent at all.
I don't remember it at all. I think Bryan Adams had more of an accent in his song, a Canadian accent, than he had in this whole movie.
Hey?
I'll cut your heart out with a spoon. Alan Rickman makes that movie so...
He really does.
Yeah, I think you're right, though. Even though he's not a very good Robin Hood, that movie is infinitely watchable. I've watched that probably 15 times over the years, and I still enjoy it.
Yeah. You can easily like triple that for me. You know, even have Christian Slater, who also slips in and out of an English accent.
And Jack Nicholson willy-nilly. Somehow. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Jack Nicholson trying to do an English accent. It is bad, you know, but he gets that great line. Like, fuck me, he made it, you know? That's such a great, everything about it. You're right. Alan Rickman is really what makes that movie so watchable, because everybody else is so chill and doing their whole, like, I'm pretending to be English thing. And the actual English guy is just rocking it and just like going everywhere phonetically. And it's just awesome.
He stands out in everything.
He does. Well, not anymore.
I know, I was thinking Scoot Out, but then that was too sad. And then Aaron went there
too
anyway.
Too soon.
People get mad when I can't help. Person no longer here. It's not. Anyway. All right. Riding that same train that John was just riding. Sean Connery, one of my favorite all-time actors. One of the best actors ever to work in film. arguably one of the best actors who can't actually act because he plays just Sean Connery and everything. But just kidding. Just kidding. I love Sean Connery. The Hunt for Red October is a great movie. I have no problems whatsoever with that movie. But you have to admit it was freaking weird to cast Sean Connery as a Russian sub-commander who has a zero Russian accent for the entire movie, even when he actually speaks Russian. He actually speaks Russian at one point and doesn't sound Russian. And nobody faulted him for it anywhere. They were all like, mm-hmm, yep, that's exactly what he should sound like. What? No.
Maybe he tried and it was so much worse that they were like, please don't. Please just do American and we'll just pretend like we forgot to check some things.
It's wild. Just do American? What?
It's Scottish.
You know what it is?
Scottish. He's Scottish.
Yeah. English. Yeah, I meant English.
That's my natural accent.
I meant to say English when I said just be American.
I'm knitting, okay? I lost track.
Poor casting choices for the podcast.
Well, don't be knitting during a podcast, number one.
No, it's relaxing. John is broken. Wow. Someone's in an ambulance. This is Russian space station.
All right. Oh my God. You know what I was just going to say, was trying to say before I lost or divided by zero just there, is that you kind of marvel at his hairpiece the entire time, too.
It is. Yeah. This is very true.
He had the best wig guy. Whoever that guy was.
He really did.
A great wig guy. I think Nick Cage called him up, but he wasn't available anymore or something. Because Nick Cage.
Oh, no. My.
What? If you think that's his natural hair, I hate to tell you. It is not.
I know, but it was just some real shade that you went there. Well,
Nick Cage needs the shade.
Somebody needs to tell him that's too dark. It's just too dark. It's not a magic marker hair thing. What are you doing? That's just weird.
Maybe he should try it for hims.com.
Ooh. Ouch. Amanda, third.
Oh, I'm back already.
Yeah, you know, if you weren't knitting. That's just weird.
You know what? Leave me be. I'm making a nice little Harry Potter scarf. You're not getting anything now.
I don't want one. I just want you to answer the question.
Maybe you were going to get something else. De Niro and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Mm. Just not the kind of guy that you picture when everybody else is in like a very historical type pose and you just got De Niro with what I presume is like a Boston accent. It's just like, how did we arrive here?
I don't remember that, but it sounds fantastic.
Yeah. It's just shocking. I think the consensus I'm realizing as we're talking about these is that they need to hire someone on set to ensure accent consistency.
Wrong. I like it better this way. It's more entertaining.
Yeah.
Yeah. You talking to me?
What are we? Like, what are we, English?
Hey, be nice to me, okay?
No, not American. English. Still not Scotland.
I meant, like, English.
You know what? English, Japanese, all the same. I get it. Yeah.
No!
It's all the same. Troy, number three.
Well, I think this is the first time you can actually say that this musical was actually named Les Miserables. Because they put a guy who could not sing at all into one of the best singing parts that we had just witnessed at the 25th anniversary edition, Live from the O, in London. And that is Russell Crowe playing Javert. Like,
I'm sorry,
worst...
Live from the O?
Yeah, Live from the O.
Okay. Get cultured.
I'm going to walk away for this one.
It's English. You wouldn't have seen it.
You wouldn't know.
It's not American.
And it's definitely not in Scotland. Russell Crowe is just terrible in this role completely. Can't sing, unfortunately, in this case, can't act either, because most of the acting involves singing at the same time, and it was just a disaster, and it was just a complete capitulation for the character. And when he finally goes over the edge and kills himself in the movie, I was just like, thank freaking God that that's over.
Did he do it with cheeseburgers?
Wow.
No.
Wow. Wow. People get mad at me. So, Troy, I got a question, because for everybody that I know that has seen them, I have not seen Les Miserables or whatever.
I haven't seen it either.
So I don't know the answer to how bad Crow was, but I've heard from everyone I've talked to, and I asked a few people about this because I saw this was your selection, and I wanted to know for sure that I knew I'd watched the movie. Is he really that bad? And they all said, movie great, Hugh Jackman fantastic, Anne Hathaway was just amazing. But yes, he almost destroyed the whole movie single-handedly. Yes. Is that true?
100%. If you are a Les Mis fan in any way, shape, or form and watched any production other than the movie, and then you watch the movie, you're like, I can never see Les Mis again.
And it's just his performance that ruins it.
Correct.
That's insane. That's crazy.
Everybody else is so great. And it's just like, just, yeah. The answer is, Russell, I am not entertained at all.
Bravo.
You know, he's just, he had that in a title card somewhere. And he's just like, I got to hold on to this one. I got this baby ready to go.
He's like, this is my moment. This is my moment. This is the me moment right now.
All right, John, what's your last one?
So my last one is one that I have to admit, I don't remember the movie at all. I know I watched it and I thought I liked it when I did watch it, but I was still stunned by this casting choice, and that's Robin Williams in 1 Hour Photo. Mm. I do remember that I found him engaging and scary and just nuts. And as I understand it, this was the role that led him into getting cast in Christopher Nolan's
Insomnia.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And that's another great role that where you find him playing something that's completely out of type for him. And this is one of those ones that just works.
He was always such an underappreciated dramatic actor, I think.
Yeah,
because absolutely. Because he was so good at literally everything he did. Any role he played, he was wonderful in. But whenever he did dark, which, you know, obviously he didn't do a ton of, but whenever he did it, unlike a lot of comedic actors who try to do very, very dark roles, it's hard for them to step out of. Jim Carrey, he's famous for, he's actually a pretty solid dramatic actor, but nobody takes him seriously in those parts because they only see him, you know, funny faces and everything, where you can get lost in a Robin Williams performance. That 1 Hour Photo is definitely a prime example of that. Insomnia, he does a bunch of other ones, but that I think is the one role where I finally saw him in a different light. Good choice. So here's one that really kind of messed me up as a kid. True story. So my grandfather's favorite actor was John Wayne. I've seen so many John Wayne westerns. I don't love John Wayne, but I like John Wayne. I mean, he's like Sean Connery. He's literally the same guy in every movie, including when he played Genghis Khan. in 1956's The Conqueror. Just to give you a quick history lesson, Genghis Khan is probably one of the most famous people of Asian descent. I mean, he's definitely in the top three, I would think. And he's the Asian chief of the Mongols, right? So we all know Asian. And in this movie, The Conqueror, where John Wayne plays Genghis Khan, they dress him up like Genghis Khan. They keep calling him Genghis Khan. Many of the cast speak in that really offensive Chinese wannabe accent, except for John Wayne as Genghis Khan, who sounds exactly like John Wayne at a Halloween party wearing Genghis Khan's outfit. It is something to build. Like, there has never been a better case for whitewashing than John Wayne as Genghis Khan in The Conqueror. And I, for the life of me, can't understand who in the right mind thought this was a good idea. Now, I'm going to explain why that messed me up as a kid. Because until I actually got to high school and had history class where they actually explained who Genghis Khan was, keep in mind, no internet, kids, so I didn't learn until I got a book with it. I thought it was a white guy. Just had a lot of Asians working for him. That's what I thought.
Oh, my.
That's what I thought. Because, Amanda, I didn't know who Genghis Khan was at the time. Like,
no, I understand.
I just knew the movie. And then history class, I'm like, well, he was a leader of the Mongols and it's Asian. And I'm like, wait, what? What? You sure it wasn't? You sure it wasn't me, Pilgrim?
Did you see that movie, though?
I'm telling you. What? Insane. Just insane. Oh, but not so fun fact. Maybe it's penance for making this movie. Just so you know, The Conqueror, almost half of that film's crew, true story, died of cancer, including John Wayne himself, and many believe it was because the movie was shot on a nuclear testing site in Utah.
Oh, wow.
Whoa. Mm-hmm. Oh, Jesus.
There's nothing good that came out of that film is what I'm saying. Nothing.
Probably one of the worst of his career.
And
not even John Wayne's lungs.
Wow. But seriously, go even find a clip of it. It's hysterical because they're talking in that broken Chinese, you know, it's that accent everybody hates, especially if you're Asian or an Asian actor, which I've heard from many Asian actors, especially recent years, who have said that they can't stand when actors have to have that accent. They're all doing that while he sounds just like himself. And it boggles my mind.
Oh, and he's got like mascara on for painting in the different eye shape, right?
Yeah, it's not.
Yes.
It's not good.
It's not a good look for Hollywood.
It's not a really good look for Hollywood, no. Okay, well, those are our picks. So listener comments, anybody, Amanda, we each went through, the topic goes in our Facebook group, and we each picked a comment from those comments. So Amanda, what do you got?
Yeah, mine's from Adam Smith, and great choice, I'm going to start off by saying, because this was my honorable mention. Keanu Reeves in Bram Stoker's Dracula, one of the worst attempts at a British accent I've seen.
Oh, yeah, he's supposed to be English.
Mm-hmm. I can't stand you guys.
Tammy Ray Spiro says, I find it interesting that we have all selected males. I'll throw in a couple of female roles. Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, who I used to think was hot way back in the day.
She was.
Did she say that or did you say that?
That was me going in my little editorial. For Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Yes, she was another one who kept on slipping in and out of her accent every now and again. And then Katie Holmes for Batman Begins, which I actually agree. Like, she sort of ruins the movie a little here and there.
Disagree.
I love that movie. I can handle her, but I do wish it was someone else.
I agree with Amanda.
Don't agree with any of you. I thought she was fine. She didn't bother me at all. And I really wish she was in The Dark Knight versus Maggie Gyllenhaal.
I do agree that she should have been in the
Dark Knight. Yeah, if she was going to be there, she should have stayed, and then it would have made it better. But because she wasn't in the second movie, it ruins the first movie. When you go watch it now.
Yep.
I'm not on board. I thought she was fine. I'm fine with you, Katie, even if Tom Cruise isn't.
Yeah, that's for the best.
Obviously.
Wendy Davies said, might be unpopular, but Tom Hanks as Robert Langdon in The Da Vinci Code. I do love Mr. Hanks, but having read all of the books, felt like he was completely the wrong fit for the character. And having seen both of those movies, I agree. It's probably the two that I do dislike Tom Hanks the most in.
Oh my gosh, sacrilege.
He's legitimately not good in those movies.
Yeah. I haven't seen them, full disclosure.
I think it's his wig that's the problem in that movie.
He does have a mullet going on or something. I don't know what the hell that was.
Yeah. But
Troy made me watch the new series, Lost, what is it, The Lost Symbol?
Well, simple, yeah. Ashley Zuckerman is actually really, really great and totally is the Robert Langdon that we should have had in the movies.
Yeah, he's really good on Peacock. You should watch that. John?
You're it.
No,
you're up, buddy.
John went.
Did he?
I already went. Yeah.
He skipped me. It was fine. I'm not butthurt about it.
No, you went. Wendy Davies. Wasn't that yours?
That was mine.
And I said Tammy Ray Spiro. Okay. And we did the Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, who
just,
I thought was
you
hot.
You just didn't go in order and you missed Troy.
And completely
and
threw off
his
the old
guy. Hurt.
Right.
I'm not hurt. I just think it's funny that he threw off the old guy because the old guy can't remember who all went.
Hey,
right.
Get off my lawn and just shut your warm mouth. All right.
Sammy!
Ty Nelson, he said, and these are three of them that I think are all spot on. Denise Richards as nuclear physicist Christmas Jones. I can't even say
yeah.
I buy that.
What?
I'm kidding. Of course I don't buy it.
Okay. I was going to say, you're kicked off.
The only thing about that works is that end line, I guess Christmas doesn't come more than one, or does come more than once a year, whatever the hell that line was. That was so ridiculous. I'm just like, okay, that almost made this whole stupid part worth it. Oh, whatever. He also says Alanis Morissette as God in Dogma. That one worked.
Oh, I liked her. I actually liked
that. That's a great move.
But it was weird. Yeah. But it was weird.
Weird. Right. Yeah, but I liked her.
Weird, but it worked.
Yeah.
And Charlton Heston as a Mexican in Touch of Evil. Yeah. Mm. Hollywood. What the hell? So there you go. Boom. Great topic, guys. That was a lot of fun. Boy, and that.
What does Charlton Heston sound like when he's trying to do a Mexican accent?
Charlton Heston. But more offensive.
John Wayne trying to do an Asian accent.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. Upcoming releases.
All right. Let's go first with Venom. Let There Be Carnage coming out October 1st in theaters exclusively. Mm-hmm. So make sure you get out and spend some money. Venom springs into action when notorious serial killer Cletus Cassidy, played by Woody Harrelson, transforms into the evil Carnage. Tom Hardy returns as the lethal protector Venom, one of Marvel's greatest and most complex characters. The film also stars Michelle Williams, Naomi Harris, and it's directed by the Andy Serkis.
King of the motion capture.
Absolutely. Then we also have coming to VOD on October 1st, Coming Home in the Dark. We will have a review at the end of the show, but it's James Ashcroft's directorial debut about a school teacher who is forced to confront a brutal act from his past when a pair of ruthless drifters take him and his family on a nighttime nightmare road trip. Stars Daniel Gillies, Eric Thompson, Miriamma McDowell. I hope I said those names right, but I probably didn't.
I'm pretty sure you did not, but I like it.
That's fine. It's fine. My apologies.
And then on Amazon Prime, we have Black as Night on October 1st. A teenage girl with self-esteem issues finds confidence in the most unlikely way by spending her summer battling vampires that prey. Oh, my God. I really want to see this now. That prey on New Orleans disenfranchised with the help of her best friend, the boy she's always pined for, and a particular rich girl. So this stars Keith David, which we all know who Keith David is. Mm-hmm. Isaiah Cooper and Abby Gale. This is directed by Marit Legault. And yeah, I'm down. What about you guys?
I'm all up for Buffy Nolo.
We've also got Witch Hunt coming to VOD on October 1st, a film which premiered at South by Southwest, actually, from Elle Callahan, who worked on Wonder Woman and Avengers Age of Ultron. And she has a new film out about a modern America where witches are real and witchcraft is illegal. And a sheltered teenager must face her own demons and prejudices as she helps two young witches avoid law enforcement as they cross the southern border to asylum in Mexico. It stars Gideon Adlon, Abigail Cohen, and Elizabeth Mitchell. And again, our spoiler-free review will be at the end of the podcast.
All right. Any recent film or TV recommendations before we move on to our next little segment?
I do want to mention a show that I've been watching that I was incredibly resistant to even giving a chance. Mm. And that is Charmed, the reboot, because I was a really big fan of the original.
I think you mentioned that in our Emmy show.
Did I?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you mentioned that on the Emmy show.
Oh, okay. Well, never mind then.
Check out Charmed. You like Charmed.
I did. I ended up liking it, yeah.
I'm just glad fall TV is back. I got to watch all my stories.
The Resident. Yes!
I watched A Million Little Things, which did not disappoint in the season premiere. Oh my premiere. Gosh.
Did you watch Foundation? Did you watch Foundation?
I did not watch Foundation yet. I was waiting for the second episode because I wanted to make like a movie event evening of it because I just had so much stuff to watch last week. I ran out of time. And I didn't get to see Evan Hansen because people were like, it's bad. It's awful. And it's like, oh man. So, but I'm going to see it eventually.
You couldn't handle it. All right. Well, now we're going to what would have happened. That's where a host posits a what would have happened scenario from popular film or TV, as in what would have happened if Thor had control of the Infinity Gauntlet? And the other hosts have to offer their theory on what would have happened after that. Troy, what's your scenario?
What would have happened if Doc Brown, at the end of the first Back to the Future movie, never connects the cable at the end? So like 2 seconds too late, just as he's about to plug it in, but it never actually plugs in. And then the lightning strikes. What would have happened?
Maybe he would have ended up with his mom.
That's exactly what I'm thinking. I think Marty does end up banging his mom. And I think it's okay because technically he isn't born yet. And so he's not really her kid. I don't know how that works. I mean,
does
I just
he disappear
feel
in the middle of it? Like, he's going away.
Well, I mean, if there's any time to disappear in the middle of anything, it's while banging Leah Thompson.
Well, banging your mom.
I was going to say, you don't want to leave in the middle of banging her, but maybe in the middle of banging your mom. Yeah.
Yeah, same difference. All right. So my, this is what I think happens. Okay. Doc Brown gets lit up like a Christmas tree by a lightning bolt. So he's
dead,
crispy, dead on the ground. Marty, because he's going, trying to go 88 miles an hour on a street road in the middle of town, loses control of the car, barrels into the side of a building. He gets paralyzed and he is, or badly hurt. And he has to deal with 1950s medicine to try to recuperate.
Oh, Jesus, this, you just made this like the worst movie ever. Go bang your mom, Marty. This just sounds terrible. I don't want to see that. God. Well, I legitimately think what happens is Marty runs into a building. Yes, he gets out of the car. Doc is just like, well, what are we going to do? And then Biff just beats a smack out of him. And then Marty, feeling beaten and wounded, goes and makes out with his mom.
Good answers. But this is what really happened.
This is a clue?
What I have to say? Where's the title card for this?
It happens exactly like it happens in the movie. The DeLorean actually disappears and you see the lightning bolt and everything happen because it actually does arc, but it doesn't have enough juice, so it doesn't actually work. So what actually happens is it's a more of an Inception kind of moment because you see Doc Brown holding the lightning. He gets struck by the lightning. He actually dies. And because he dies, the construct of the movie is that technically then the DeLorean never would have been made, so therefore the DeLorean would have vanished. So the audience is thinking that it actually worked, but really it didn't. And Marty and the DeLorean vaporized into existence into nothing.
I like that.
And then you fade out at the last shot. The last shot is the cable not connected on the ground.
Oh, and then we're spared the two sequels. I like it.
Oh, yeah.
No, I think this is a better way to go. Just do a director's
cut. Yeah, I'm not sure who has a darker ending, but, you know, me or Troy. But
I like Troy. Troy's seems...
But Troy's ending is good.
Yeah, I like it.
He actually thought about it.
She's saying you
compared
didn't think
to
about
me. I'm like, well, no, I just meant like the obvious answer is he bangs his mom. Of course. It
feels like that's right. You know,
I mean, because he would be stuck there because the DeLorean never got made. So you'd have to do something, right? If Doc Brown were to die.
Troy is so proud of himself right now.
He really is.
He is so proud of himself. He's sipping from this like water bottle ever so suggestively about how proud he is.
This very phallic water bottle. Yeah.
He's got a dimple showing. He's glowing.
McGolden or something.
All right. Well, we've got reviews coming up. But before we do that, share your thoughts on this episode or anything else in our Facebook group, which is The Hollywood Outsider. You can find it on Facebook. You got to look for it. We're on Twitter at BuyPopcorn. Our site is TheHollywoodOutsider.com. Please share the show with your friends. Whatever social app you use, it really does help the podcast. Or review us in Apple Podcasts, too. We haven't had one there in a while, and it does help the show bounce up the charts. So go to Apple Podcasts and review us real quick. You can find John's artwork on Insta and Twitter at rjohndraws, Amanda on Veronica's Marshmallows and Smirk, and at Sink Into This on Twitter, Troy at Troy Heinrichs and The Blacklist Exposed, and me and Presenting Hitchcock and at Aaron Smirks. John and Troy are going to depart because they have not watched any of these things, I believe, or are you guys sticking around?
Nope. Eject. See you guys later. Next week. Bye.
We've got some spoiler-free reviews, and the first is Coming Home in the Dark, which again is coming to VOD on October 1st. Aaron saw this one. Just to give you a little recap in case you skipped to the reviews, it's about a school teacher who is forced to confront a brutal act from his past when a pair of ruthless drifters take him and his family on a nightmare road trip. So Aaron, this is from a fresh director in terms of feature film. What did you think of James Ashcroft's concept and his execution?
I like the tone. I like the bleakness. I like the somberness of the story. So I think he has a good aesthetic, like a good visual aesthetic. Like he really bleeds into the moment and kind of captures you. And there's some definite sudden shocking violence in spots that it doesn't feel manufactured, doesn't feel forced. It actually worked for the scenes. And so I feel like he's definitely finding his groove as a director.
In terms of this story, because when I hear road trip, I'm immediately thinking something that's going to take a long time. You're going to be spending a lot of time in the car, maybe some stops. So it could be very much a slow burn. But you're also talking about some pretty dire circumstances. So does this feel like a slow burn, or does it keep the pacing up really nice and fill it with action?
I hate the term slow burn. I just hate the term slow burn.
It's not a bad thing. It's just, no, but it's some a people descriptor.
Hear, yeah, some people hear that and they're just like, slow burn? What's that? That means that there's just nothing but talking and driving, which really is really what happens. So there's a lot of talking and driving in this movie. It is a slow burn. It's very much a character piece. If you do not get into methodic, melodramatic character pieces, this is not a movie for you, is what I would say. It is very much a slow burn building to the final act.
And in terms of our casting, we've got three different actors that seem to be the most predominant. Daniel Gillies, who was in The Originals, a great CW show if you never watched it. Eric Thompson and Miriamma McDowell. And I'm curious, when you have these actors who are in a slower progressed film, the pacing moves a little bit slower, you're spending a lot of time in dialogue, those actors become pivotal to the success of the film. So did their performances stand out, and did they keep you intrigued the whole way through?
Yeah, it's really tricky, because basically you've got a school teacher and his wife and their kids that basically are accosted by some drifters, and Daniel Gillies is the lead drifter, Mandrake. Now, I didn't see The Originals, and I think he's in Virgin River, too, if I'm not mistaken. His accent, because it's a New Zealand film, his accent is so thick, it's very hard to understand what he's saying in certain spots. That is a distraction. And maybe that's not fair, because I'm just a, you know, dumb old American, whatever, but it was very difficult to understand portions of the dialogue. So I had to rewind many times just to make sure I understood what was being said, because, I mean, it's a thicker accent and it was being done very quickly. It does make it harder to just sit back and enjoy the piece. You know what I mean? But as a villain, I thought he was a very, very talented actor in the role, because he really had me engaged in what was going on. I mean, he was very sociopathic. I mean, I never knew what he was going to do, and that mattered. And he also never really lashed out. It was all very, it was calm anger is what it was. So whenever there was some kind of sporadic violence, or there was some kind of tendency toward violence, it wasn't something that you saw coming. It wasn't predictable. It was very unpredictable in nature, and he was very good at that. Eric Thompson and Miriamma McDowell were very good as the couple that were being tortured, but a lot of their role was just being scared. So they didn't really have a whole lot of depth in that respect, I guess.
Okay. And if the full price of admission were $10 for this film, again, Coming Home in the Dark, what are you giving that?
I give it $5.50. I think it's definitely worth a watch. Once you get to the final act and you get the payoff, I don't know if it's necessarily worth, I don't think the payoff is as strong as it should be, or as powerful as it could be. And I do feel like some of the dialogue is very hard to understand, which makes it hard to really get into the film in parts.
Fair enough. Yeah. It does sound like if you're a longtime fan of Daniel Gillies, that you'll enjoy his performance, because it sounds very similar to his other performances. I don't want to say that he's typecasted here, but he tends to be that very, you know, controlled, stoic. Stoic. And then you can just, there's emotions that you're not physically seeing that are kind of hidden and repressed, and then they unleash in a different way.
He's good in the role. That's good. I just couldn't understand parts of it, you know, and it makes it hard. And there's no subtitles on a screener link, so it's really hard to understand certain parts. You have to rewind it until you get it. Because, I mean, if I'm going to review it, I have to make sure I understood it. And that, I can honestly say, rarely ever happens. So it was pretty thick.
Yeah, and he has a lower toned voice as well. And I feel like sometimes it's just harder to hear him in general. So
then we have Witch Hunt. This is one I think we were both kind of excited for. In a modern America where witches are real and witchcraft is illegal. A sheltered teenager must face her own demons and prejudices as she helps two young witches avoid law enforcement and cross the southern border to asylum in Mexico. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of like The Handmaid's Tale for witches.
Yeah, yeah. That's what it reminded me of, too.
It was an interesting story because they take it very seriously. And the law says you can't practice witchcraft. So a lot of times the people that are trying to bust you will trick you to do some witchery. Mm-hmm. And that's how they get you. So it's an interesting concept. So
the law doesn't also seem to really care about the law, though.
Yeah, the law is pretty vague in this flick. What did you think about Witch Hunt?
I liked it. It did not meet my expectations because...
Well, let me know, what were your expectations? Did you think it was going to be a big thriller? Because it's really more of a drama. It's almost like A Handmaid's Tale
I mean, that's a really good
description. Look at how sad these witches have it.
Yeah. And you do feel bad for them, and you're trying to figure out if they're going to survive. And, like, that's the thriller part of it. And the horror is, I guess, more just what they do to the witches. Like, that part's pretty terrifying and awful. And also how they determine who's a witch by, like, being a ginger, I guess, basically.
Well, obviously. I think we all know that. That is science.
So I liked it, though. I think you liked it a little bit less than I did. You had more problems with it. I didn't mind it so much.
I was bored a lot.
Oh.
Yeah. That's really my biggest problem is I don't feel like it was engrossing enough. I think the acting was all fine. I love the idea. The idea is clever. No, maybe that's an expectation thing. Maybe I thought there'd be a little bit more witchery going on.
They could have used...
it was more almost family drama.
Yeah, they could have used a little bit more witchery and it could have gone a little bit darker. I also, because this is like PG-13, it felt like, more so, like it could have gone.
Like a CW TV movie
it
of the week.
Yes, it did feel a little CW-y. I also feel like they could have explored more into what they do to the witches. There was, to create some like drama or tension, they have like a flashback and then you see one scene of like a really horrible scene. But I didn't feel like it really created enough fear in us for these law enforcement people. Like, we're only, quote unquote, afraid of them because the witches are. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really feel like I was fully bought into that.
And they were kind of one note.
Yeah.
I mean, almost. I mean, there were moments where I was expecting some mustache twirling. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So what did you give Witch Hunt?
I gave it 550. I thought it was worth a watch, but not much more than that.
Yeah, it's one. If it was on Netflix, I'd watch it. You know, streaming. But I give it $5.
Okay.
I did have a real problem with Elizabeth Mitchell, who I love. I love. She's been.
Really didn't like her, huh?
No, I love her. But I had a problem with her wardrobe. Because how do you make this woman wear these clothes?
was going to say, she was enchanting.
Almost looked frumpy. How do you make this woman look frumpy? She's gorgeous.
I don't know that I thought she looked frumpy, but
I didn't like her wardrobe. It stood out to me.
Oh, here we go. A man judging a woman on her appearance. Oh, here we go.
I know. I'm judging the costume designer. I'm saying they could have done better. All right, we're going to move on to Midnight Mass now. We're not going to give any spoilers away. We're going to dance around some of the finer points. There are some twists here. We're not going to give any of those away. So without giving any of that away, here's the story. Mike Flanagan returns to Netflix. That's Haunting of Hill House, Haunting of Bly Manor, Gerald's Game. With a new story, apart from his Haunting of franchise, that follows the small community of Crockett Island, a remote island off the West Coast. There are roughly 127 people that live here, and there isn't much to do except fish and pray. Well, Riley lost his way years ago when he killed a young woman in a drunk driving accident, and he's sent home with his family for parole. His parents are God-fearing, his community is too, and Riley just isn't about that Jesus life. In walks a new priest to town, and Hamish Linklater's Father Paul. Now he's charismatic, he's alluring, also a little bit mysterious. Though parishioners like the ultra-devoted Bev and Riley's long-lost love Aaron, who's played by Kate Siegel, are all fond of Father Paul, Riley is a little bit reluctant, and then miracles start happening on Crockett Island. Now, Amanda, that's about as much into the overall story as I probably want to get. Fair enough?
Yeah, you could get very spoilery very quickly.
Okay. Well, you and I watched this 7-episode series on Netflix, which is definitively ended, by the way. So if you're worried that it's going to leave a cliffhanger or anything like that, no, they have an ending, just like Haunting of Hill House or Bly Manor. But unlike those, I would say that this one is a bit more predictable in story structure, but there tended to be a bit more meat to chew on thematically. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say that's a pretty fair assessment. There's some pretty heavy markers along the way to indicate what's to come if you're paying attention. And mm-hmm. I say that where you don't really have to fully be paying attention to understand, okay, yeah, this isn't what it seems. That is different than what I think, but it's inevitably what I think it is, sort of thing. And so it has some predictability to it, but overall it keeps you enticed and it keeps you wanting more. You kind of have a hunger, if you will, to know what's going to happen next. And I'll say that there's this really wonderful thing that Flanagan does of keeping you on your edge until the very, very end and then just leaving you, is to kind of like sit in those thoughts and emotions about mm-hmm. what is happening, what just happened at the end of the episode.
Now, how did you feel about this? Horror revolving religion often ignores the people who are richly devoted. And that always kind of bothers me. You know, part of my family is religious, part of my family is not. So I kind of see both sides of that in many respects. And I always feel like if you're going to have a story that it revolves around religion, you have to be fair. You can't, if you're an atheist, you can't just bring an atheist point of view to it, because otherwise I don't think you're being fair to the other side. You know, it's like anything else. There's two sides to an argument. And I felt like this series had a healthy balance of zealots, you know, who are too religious, and genuinely good people, as there are in any religion or society, genuinely good people that just believe in God. Did you agree with that? Do you feel like they had a fair representation of the Rileys and the Aarons in the world and the Bevs?
Yeah, they're not rubbing it too hard in your face about who is evil. The evilness is not defined by the religion, I guess I'll say, mm-hmm. because there's a lot of films, especially in horror, like you said, where they paint religious folk as the most evil, or in other ones where the non-believers are the evil ones. And here, that's not the deciding factor. That's actually more of, while it's the a core piece of the series or the show, it is not a defining factor for the characters' behaviors and movements. And it's more about the evilness of people and mindsets, yep. because everyone has a different perspective. So you really never know who's going to respond what way based on their religion.
And it feels to me like Mike Flanagan is really demonstrating. I mean, he's doing it through his usual means, you know, he's doing it through a horror show, but he's kind of alluding to how much of the extremists among us, whatever it is, religion, culture, 9/11 is touched on in this show, whatever it is, the extremists in our world are making choices. And I feel like the show is really touching on, these are people who make choices. Even people with extreme views make choices if they do extreme things. Just because they feel a certain way doesn't mean that they necessarily will act a certain way. And I feel like mm-hmm. that's a big focal point of the show, is that he's alluding to religion is an important part of this town. And yes, some people in town, I mean, Bev is very much like the modern Mrs. Carmody, if you ever saw The Mist.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah. So an extremist in that respect, where other characters are very, like Aaron Green, who's Kate Siegel, she's very devout, but she makes different choices. So therefore she, her character can go different ways, you know? And I feel like that's what he's trying to say, is don't base everything just on the fact that they go to church. Base it on the people, you know what I mean? Cause the people make choices, and that's what leads to whatever they end up doing. I mean, that's what I took from the show.
And to your point, there's one thing that Flanagan does really well that I always enjoy, and you get to see it here. Some directors give you a resolution through dialogue or through a forced plot device to make something happen. And in the show, the reveals are based on choices. You know, the big moments, in the one in episode 5 is all I'm going to say, is a choice. There's characters who are choosing to, rather than just talk about some things in exposition or something, you get that moment where the character has to decide, what do I want to do? How do I want to handle this? And I always enjoy that contemplation and seeing the final reveal of their decision, where he uses the characters to drive everything forward.
And speaking of characters, the reason why Mike Flanagan and his work, I really respond to him as a writer and as a director, is because he takes the time to develop a character and a scenario. And granted, they give him like 9 or 10 episodes, but so many 9 or 10 episodes that I've watched get too fleshed out. They just drag on. There's cheap horror plot. There's cheap scares. There's a lot of cats jumping out of cupboards. Where, why are you in the cupboard? Why? That doesn't make any sense. Who put you in the cupboard? Someone should answer that question. I mean, all of these things aren't really part of his show. His show is more about the mild inflections, the character development, the characters developing as people and by their choices, like you said, and kind of moving on to other things and subtle background things. So he almost puts Easter eggs for the characters themselves in the show. You know what I mean? I mean, you could see it in the Haunting shows where you'd see ghosts in the background. You could go back and see ghosts and whatnot. You can see here where you see different characters, you know, where eyes are popping out of nowhere, things like that. I mean, there's little subtle things that normally a director would make sure it would have a huge musical cue, so you knew that was there right then. That doesn't happen in his shows. It's more about, you better pay attention, because if you're looking at your phone, you're probably going to miss something. And I love that. I love that he actually takes the time to develop things like that, where if you miss it, you might have missed out on a crucial clue. And that's on you. Pay attention.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of Easter eggs in that respect that connect directly to the content you're watching, but he also throws in some nice Easter eggs to other content that he's created. And I don't want to say what they are, because then you might be looking for them. But there are a couple in here that will be like, oh, okay, if you're a longtime fan of his, you may catch some of those things.
I will tell you this part. This isn't really a spoiler. It's not a spoiler. Don't freak out. Midnight Mass, it is a real book, but this property is not based on that book. It's actually, it's his own idea and his own story. But if you go back and watch his movie Hush, if you go watch Gerald's Game, both of those properties had Midnight Mass, the book, a book in it as part of the actual story for those. So it's something that's been in his mind for a long time. And he finally got, because he shopped around other TV networks and they wouldn't bite on it. Then he had huge success with the Haunting series and Netflix gave him the money finally to make the property he wanted to make. Great story. And I want to point out, I know, Manda, you're not as much of a Stephen King fan as I am, but Flanagan has done several Stephen King properties like Gerald's Game, and he did Dr. Sleep. And I have to mention that a lot of this series has echoes of Stephen King coursing through its veins. From a lot of the story setup, the character setup, it's almost like a sleepy New England town. The
tone, very much.
Yeah, the tone. I mean, all of it across the board feels very Stephen King-ish. Even though it's Flanagan's own voice, I can tell it's somebody who loves Stephen King that wrote this.
Yeah, and I think you can see it in the visuals, too, in some of the scenes where it's what's there, what could be there, where it's taunting your imagination in many ways. And there was one scene in particular I had to rewind like 3 times because I was like, I can't tell if my mind is playing tricks on me and what I'm seeing or what I'm not seeing. And that just, to me, that is what I connect to Stephen King as, is just that. What's my mind just feels like it's being messed with sometimes.
Well, he even has a couple stories that are similar in vein to this in a way. So, but I don't want to mention those because they might might be a giveaway to those people that haven't seen this. So the casting here is pretty stellar once again, and some of them are from his previous show. I mean, Henry Thomas is back, Kate Siegel's back. You know, there's Annabeth Gish is back. There's several people that are back. And I wasn't kidding. Rename this thing Midnight Monologues and it would work because there's a lot of monologues. Lot.
There are. Them.
But some really good ones. There's some good pontific, like rumination on death. I think there's some scenes for that that are very interesting on religion, on belief, on what we should blame. Like lots of conversations that really are deep and meaningful and powerful in that respect.
And moments. There's some female-centric moments that occur. And I'm hesitant to say anything again because I don't want it to be spoilers, even though it doesn't directly connect with the story, but it would give something away. And so those moments to me feel really powerful. And the initial connection in the first episode, I'll say, where they're going through the story of what happened to Riley and his drinking and his addiction and his jail experience and then getting out of jail, and all of this is occurring in the first little bit of the episode, is very, and how the people respond to him and the struggles that he has for years and years after, that is something that personally connected me as someone who has had some really unpleasant experiences with addiction and the ramifications of that. And his character development in this series was just, was crazy. It was pretty wonderful to see where his character went.
Yeah. There's a lot of interesting choices because characters make developed choices, and that really, really works. So the one thing about all the monologues is that almost every actor in this show gets a chance to deliver a monologue of some sort. Almost every single one of them. But nobody really failed to deliver when they were given that big scene. Like, they all got a chance to eat, actors say. We all got our meal. Any standouts to you? Like, any one or two actors really blew you away with their performance?
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Samantha Sloyan, who plays Bev Keen, because she is such a monstrous character in many ways. And her delivery just feels somewhat monotoned, but also very vindictive and creepy at the same time. And so I've really enjoyed her performance, and I've enjoyed hating her a whole lot. I do hate her character a whole lot from the first moment she came on the screen. And I want to mention, I guess, someone that's more of a side character that I've really enjoyed. And that's Raul Coley, who plays Sheriff Hassan. Mm. And the personal journey that he's on as a character and the stories that he tells and the way he tells them really just have an impact that I think a lot of people who are maybe not as familiar with different cultures and different religions and different experiences, they may not have understood where his perspective is coming from. And these stories are coming from. And so that's one that really stood out to me. And especially coming as like a comedian and someone who is so funny and so bright, to have this performance, which is much more serious all of the time, I was really impressed with him.
Yeah, and how he just deals with casual racism on a regular basis. And like, people that like him, they refer to him as Sharif, which, that's funny, yeah. Right? It's not. And he just rolls with it, and he just, you know, deals with it because he just doesn't want to cause
the relationship he has with his child in this show. It's mm-hmm. honest, but it's so deep. I feel like it's so much deeper than most parents have with their children about religion. And it's also, it's showing you perspectives that you don't really think about, where you get to see the child's perspective of why they are wanting to, you know, venture out, and why a parent may say, no, let's venture out and explore and learn, but let's also stay true to who we are.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Zach Guilford was very good as Riley. Kate Siegel, she's always great as Erin Green.
Yeah, those two are wonderful.
But obviously the one that I think stood out the most is Hamish Linklater as Father Paul. It's a hard role to really win you over on, because, and I can't really say because he goes through a lot of character development and in terms of what his choices have been and are going to be throughout the series. And also he has some wild monologues, some where he has to be monotone, some where he has to be just extremely vibrant and loud, where he's delivering these church sermons. And it's almost like a Baptist preacher more than a Catholic Breacher because he's just so animated and vocal and powerful and selling them on the word of the Lord, you know, like all of that. And he's so good at it. Like he's just very good at it. He really impressed me. Really did.
Yeah, there were many times in this where I was transported back to Mass. And I was like, oh, I'm back here. Okay. they don't let Mass last as long as it truly does, but they shorten that somehow. But it does feel that way in his performance as he's guiding them through life with words of the Lord. And the way he does that and how he, when he chooses to change his inflection and when he chooses to be boisterous and loud and, you know, very powerful versus very monotoned and calm and collected and trying to keep you calm and collected. And he's very intentional with it, I've found. And I've just really enjoyed him.
Yeah, very, very much so. The only negative I would say about the show for me personally was, I will say, very positive 7 episodes. They didn't drag it out, which I appreciated. It wasn't, I really felt like Blind Manor was drug out. So it was nice. I know not everybody agrees with me, but I thought it was too long. This felt like the right length. I think it started and ended right about as long as it should have been. And but on a negative, or not necessarily negative, but something that really bothered me is there's a couple actors who were playing older than they are. And it was very distracting. And it was very distracting. And you'll understand why as you watch and whatnot, but it is distracting. It was painfully obvious. Every scene they're in, it totally takes you out of it.
It does. Yep.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. That was one thing and I know exactly who you're talking about, but when that person came on screen and I was like, that's odd. And I figured out, oh, I understand why this choice has happened.
Yep.
And that was like, it was so obvious that it hurt the show just a teeny tiny bit.
Almost spoiled
where I was like, okay, I get it. Did it. Yep. It did. I think I would have been less knowledgeable in advance had that choice not been made.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think that was.
And there was an easy way to fix that.
I think Flanagan is great. I think that was a miscalculation.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
That was a miscalculation. All right. So any other points you want to discuss before we wrap up Midnight Mass?
No, really enjoyed it. I would highly recommend it.
If $10 full price of admission, what do you give Midnight Mass?
I'm going to give it $8.
Okay. I'm going $7.50. That aging thing was a real problem. All right. what do you want to see next from Mike Flanagan? Do you want him to go back to the haunting world? Do you want him to do something like this where it's its own new, different kind of world? What do you want to see?
Aaron, truthfully, I don't care as long as he's making new content because he is just such a delight to see where his mind is going to go and what he is going to take out of something. He's invented new things. He's reinvented things. And it always seems to come out as a collective enjoyment for people who even otherwise might not enjoy horror, but can get on board with this. And so I want him to stay in this genre of horror and thriller as much as he can. I'm happy if he wants to expand and try some different horizons, but I want him to keep bringing us this awesome content.
You're right. I'm going to bump it up to 8 just for that, because he makes good content. Good content.
He does. And yeah, Netflix content. Like when I think about Netflix and quality, like genuinely quality competitive content, his series are some of the first to come to mind.
They are the first that come to my mind.
Stranger Things is the first that comes to mind.
Okay. Okay.
And all then, right. And then the these Witcher. Come after.
Maybe The Witcher.
But these are shows that you could say easily compete with HBO and all of these big ones that have lots of money behind all the shows, whereas Netflix does like little drops here and there for so many shows.
Yep. And I'm with you. I just want to see whatever he does next. I actually don't want another haunting of for a while, maybe another year or two. I love that he's got these things dropping every roughly Halloween season because that's the time of year when I want something like this. And, you know, I love horror movies and I'll rewatch a bunch of stuff, but it's nice to get something new that I can get invested in, characters I can get invested in. I really love this, that he brings back random characters and actors. Not characters. He brings back random actors from previous works.
Yeah.
You know, Carla Gugino is in most of his stuff. And I think she does a cameo here in one of the episodes as a voice or something. But Henry Thomas is here again, like I said. His wife, you know, and I hate to say his wife, Kate Siegel, because that makes it sound like she's only in it because he's the director. And that's just not the case. She's a very good actress. You know, I kind of wish she would go off and have a career on her own without him, honestly. I just think she's that good.
is that good, where I would love to see her expand and work with some different directors at this point in her career and try some different things. But they do have a really magnetic working relationship together.
Sure. Yeah. So if that works for you, keep going. Keep going. If you've never seen Hush, that's on Netflix, and that is well worth a watch. That's a great movie.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It's a great movie. Great time to watch it around Halloween. Okay, that's going to do it. So thanks, everybody, for listening. I hope you check out Midnight Mass and everything else we talked about. Bam, that was our episode. And Amanda, thanks for joining me and sticking around.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And remember, the next time you head to a theater or sit comfortably on your couch and watch Midnight Mass on Netflix, buy popcorn.
Do we share the exciting news?
What's the exciting news?
What do you mean, what's the exciting news? We're going back to South by Southwest next year in person.
You shared it. Congratulations.
Good job.
John, you're here.
Where did you come from? Look at that. The news is so exciting. It brings John back to the podcast. He left like 20 minutes ago.
I love that that's all he came for. He just said that. He's like, all right, I'm gone.
Okay. And I got on here like a small talk because I feel like we don't have any at the beginning. We kind of rush that sometimes. I think we've always done that, but some small talk is okay. Just not 27 minutes of randomness.
Okay.
How you doing?
Hang on. I mean, right now. Hang on, jackass.
Just he hasn't started.
Literally, we haven't started yet. You got to wait till I start. Family.
Can someone explain to me what UHD means?
Ultra HD.
But how does that differ from HD?
It's ultra.
Isn't HD 10K and then 4K is ultra HD?
HD is 2K.
All right.
Okay.
Basically, it seems like a marketing ploy. Is that correct?
When we have a giveaway, why don't we not insult the people that are giving it away?
No, it's not the people. It's just about UHD and HD. Isn't that like...
I believe it's UHD and Blu-ray are the two different formats.
Oh, is HD just for like streaming?
It means ultra high definition. It's 4K. It's the cleanest version of
4K.
Blu-ray. It's the cleanest version of the film that exists. That's what it means.
Just trying to understand the real difference. God.